Welcome to Hashtag No Filter with me, Stephanie and A, podcast which provides career advice from industry experts. Every episode, you'll hear how each trailblazing guest built success and what they do to bring a sense of wellness into their world. You're listening to real people with real stories, with real success, and who need no filter. Hello everyone, welcome to Hashtag No Filter. This is Stephanie, I'm the host of the podcast, and joining me today is Chandni Moda. Chandni is the founder of CJM Publicity, a luxury brand partnership and entertainment marketing agency whose clients include the likes of Dolce & Gabbana, Nicholas Kirkwood, and Piaget. During the episode, Chandni provides both career and business advice to those seeking a career in all aspects of the entertainment marketing and event management industry. She also talks about the future of luxury fashion and how to maintain a healthy well-being whilst building an international and highly regarded agency, just like CJM Publicity. So welcome to Hashtag No Filter, Chandni. It's great to have you here. I have been so excited for this episode for such a long time. I cannot tell you how honoured I am to finally be able to welcome you on the show.
Oh, thank you, Stephanie. It's great to be here on your No Filter podcast. I know it's been a while since we're trying to sit down and actually record it, but finally we're here, so I'm very excited to be talking to you.
The wait is absolutely worth it. I know that you're busy jet setting all over the place, that we're going to be talking a little bit about later on today. So why don't we kick off the interview by getting you to introduce yourself and talk to us a little bit about your career journey to date.
I'm Chandni Moda, the founder of CJM Publicity, a luxury brand partnerships agency based out of the UK.
Excellent. So we're going to come back on to talk about your career and, you know, your current jobs. But I thought that we could talk, well, I thought that we could backtrack a little bit and talk about your education and talk about, you know, the journey that's led you to where you are today. So what inspired you to study fashion design? And can you tell us about the Central Saint Martins experience? Because I know it's an absolutely prestigious school, and, you know, you just have to be so artistic, I suppose, to go there. So yeah, could you tell us a little bit about your experience there?
So I think going back to the beginning of your question, I was always this creative young child. Like, I was always like drawing and painting and like putting on shows and acting and changing my clothes and doing fashion shows from like when I was 4 years old. And then actually I was born and brought up within a family business, a sari shop, which we actually still goes on, which we still have in Leicester. So I was always surrounded by saris and fabrics and fashion. And my grandfather actually started the business in the 60s, like I think 1967 or 1968 or something, in Africa. And then he brought the business over to Leicester. So as a child, I was like put in the shop. I always say like I grew up in a sari shop, like after school, at the weekends, we're always, because my parents always worked, everybody, it was a family business, so everybody worked in the shop. So I was just always just there when I was a child. So I think from an early age, I was inspired to, you know, I guess like follow my career into fashion. Fast forward on to school, I think one of the subjects I did really well in was like textiles and art, more than I wasn't very much like science, maths, or literally my brain didn't work in that field, but the creative side, yes. So I was very much like, you know, I won all the competitions, all the art prizes, all the like the Student of the Year awards. And then I actually somehow convinced, you know, coming from an Indian family background, I convinced my parents to let me go to an art college. So I think that's where it all started off. I went to actually Leicester College of Arts. Yes, I actually don't know what it's called anymore. I think it's still called Leicester College of Arts, where I actually did a degree in fashion design alongside textiles and business planning. So that was like my college 2-year course, where I completely excelled. And there was actually, I won Student of the Year, I won other various prizes. And then I did this whole portfolio of like knitwear and fashion and textiles and, you know, name it. It was all there ready to go. So the college actually put me forward to apply for Central St. Martin's. I didn't know whether I'd get it because I was like, it was so far removed. Like, I think one person from the college had ever like even applied or gone to university there. So I was like, okay, let's like, they were like, you've got something in you. Let's like push you forward and see, you know, if you can get a place or even an interview. So I think that was like the first hurdle where I worked actually, I think 2-3 weeks on my portfolio every night, like during the day, every night. I didn't go out anywhere. Like I was so focused, so driven to be like, okay, if I'm getting this opportunity to get have an interview at one of the world's most prestigious universities, I have to put my all into it. So then, yes, luckily enough, I did get an interview and I went to London on the train with my parents as well, because I was so nervous and I couldn't carry my portfolio. It was so big. So as I had my dad was like, I'm gonna have to come with you to carry this big heavy portfolio. So then I went to St. Martin's. I had the interview, which actually surprisingly went very well. They're very interested in like my background again, where like what drove me to work in fashion, you know, my family business, my like future goals. There was a lot of talking, and I mean, they saw the portfolio as well. So I guess they were looking at the standard of work as well. But I came out of the interview thinking, like, did it go well? Did it not? It was like very like, okay, I like don't know what to expect. Because I'm not one of them, the usual Central St. Martin candidates who are like ultra creative. And, you know, I don't have pegs in my hair, and which people do have pegs in their hair.
Before you go on, what do you mean pegs in their hair?
Yeah, this is one girl who was in my year at the time. She used to have like washing line pegs.
Oh,
yeah. She just walks into university with these pegs all in her hair.
Very
avant-garde. Like, used to wear tutus and, you know, all these like ridiculous outfits, which I guess was like a way of expressing herself then. But I mean, it was never.
Sound very SJP, so I'm quite down with that.
And then I was like, I am a creative and I dress a certain way, but I'm not like avant-garde creative. So in my mind, I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to get this, but anyway, let's just go for it. And then I did, and they got back to me and they offered me a place at university, and I was over the moon. So I think that's where my journey began at St. Martin's. So then I guess whilst I was at St. Martin's, it was very different. I don't know, like there's the pros and cons. They kind of get you ready for the real world, but they'll tell you straight. I remember at the crits that we'd have and we have to present our work, there was no like, oh, okay, like next time you can do this. They literally tell you to your face, like it's terrible, or, you know, they knock your confidence, or there's so many things that used to happen. But I guess that's what makes you resilient and, you know, gives you the strength to work in the fashion industry, because it's not an easy place to be. And I think since then as well, a lot of people who, I think me and one other person are the only other students from my year who are still in fashion. Everybody else had dropped out or started and they just couldn't hack it. So as much as it's like you hear all the horror stories from St. Martin's, I think it's a great place to be and work, and it prepares you for like the real life. The fashion.
I mean, just going back to being at college in Leicester, mm-hmm. and you had kind of like your cheerleaders rooting yeah. for you and nurturing your talent and kind of like pushing you, it just kind of like goes to show how important, I think anyway, how important mentors are, because although ultimately like it's you, it's your talent and you're the one that really has to work for it, I just think that mentors and people around you who can help nurture your talent are just so important. So yeah, it's nice to see that these supporters really do exist, because I'm sure that other people, like many people, haven't had such great experiences. Like, yeah. They have a term for somebody who's called a term for somebody who is the complete opposite of a cheerleader, but I can't remember what.
Someone who sort of brings you down.
Yeah.
I mean, I strongly believe in mentorship. I mentor actually a few students who have actually gone on. I met them. She like reached out to me on LinkedIn. She was like, please, will you mentor me? I'm starting this brand, which actually originally started off as a fashion brand. And then I think through my mentorship, I was like, maybe the jewelry side is better. And now, Hanim Shilpa, actually, she's from San Francisco, was actually a Harvard student. For starters, I was like, you're from Harvard. What help do you need from me? But she's incredible. She's created this duet pinky ring, which it's amazing how she's done it. And I don't even know how I managed to mentor her through this. It was definitely all her. But she had people from like Michelle Obama to like Emma Watson to Serena Williams, all of them wearing this pinky ring, which is like you wear this ring as a symbol of your support for women, supporting women, and then you pass on your mentorship onto another person. You can buy the rings. They have a website, and they actually donate, I think 50% of the profits go towards young female founded businesses, and they help them grow into like bigger young female founded startups. So the funds from that, they literally, you can apply for it, but you have to be a young female, you know, from like anywhere around the world, and then they give the funds to like certain female founded businesses.
So it's a genuine social enterprise.
Social enterprise, yeah. And then like funny enough, like I was like her first mentor from, I think it's been about 5 years, and you know, I kind of showed her how to contact celebrities, how to get in touch with stylists, like actually how to do partnerships. You know, she had no idea, and I was just like, oh, you can do this. I was like, email this person. I checked the email for her, and then she sent it out, and then I connected to somebody else that I knew, and I connected to someone else. And then now I'm like, you're running a better business than I am. But she, like, you know, that whole team, they really appreciate it. And they always mention that I was like the first person who like held their hand through the business. And now they're thriving. I mean, now they have Michelle Obama as a mentor. So,
and just reverting to your experience at St. Central Martins. Mm-hmm. When I spoke to Kaushik Valendra asked him kind of like the same question, he spoke about the school kind of just really bringing out the true artist in you. And it sounds like you were talking about there's lots of avant-garde people that people would, I suppose, perceive as, you know, the Central St. Martin's type. But it's nice to see that they don't have a cliche kind of type, and that they will help nurture anybody and give them the tools and the backbone, it sounds like, to go out there.
The backbone, I think it really like builds your foundation. So I think going to Central St. Martin's, they give you the tools to build a strong, solid foundation so you can actually hack, you know, the rest of the fashion world. They're not going, you know, going around in circles saying, oh, it's going to be like this and they're going to be nice to you. They're like, nope, this is exactly how it's going to be, and you're going to have to be tough and deal with it and not cry about it. Yeah. I mean, we've all cried, I think, at one point at being at St. Martin's, but it, you know, you go from it, it's worth it in the end.
Yeah, they give you confidence at the same time they keep you grounded.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I think Kaushik had a very different experience to what I had. I mean, I was lucky. I was also surrounded by family and friends, so I did have a lot of support whilst I was at Central St. Martin's. But I think Kaushik came from India, and it was a culture shock for him, like not being around family, you know, the everyday food and living wherever he's used to in India, and coming over here, and probably the cold as well. I think for him, like this weather. I remember being actually at I think it was the Charing Cross campus, and I did a fashion design with knitwear, and we were on the 7th floor, and oh my god, there was no heating up there, and they had broken windows. And I remember doing this pattern cutting class, and my hands were freezing, like everyone was shaking whilst they were doing like the pattern cutting. But like I was like, oh my god, like this is like, can't be, you know, legal. Like, I'm sure you'd have to have heating in there, but no, it was just so tough. I think by like about 3 o'clock or something, I was like, I need to go home. I was like, I can't work in these conditions. But now they have this beautiful campus in King's Cross, which I like really envy. I was like, look at this lovely campus with like all this inspiration around you. And I was like, I was there in the heydays, like on the seventh floor with broken windows. But I remember that. So, you know, it's all these little things.
Exactly. It builds character, I suppose. You potentially wouldn't have been the person you are today without that freezing cold experience.
Experience.
At least you were doing your knitwear kind of collection.
I was doing, yeah, the funny thing is I was doing knitwear.
It kept you a little bit warm.
Yeah. Well, all these, like, big yarn bottles of them. I used to carry them in a suitcase all the way up to the seventh floor. Oh, it was insane. I could barely lift it. I mean, I couldn't even lift my portfolio for my interview. So how is he going to lift these, all these, like, bottles of yarn?
You did make it out of the cold. And you went on to pursue a career in PR and brand development in luxury fashion. So I understand that a couture fashion house approached you to intern at its London celebrity PR office. What did you do, or how did you make them? Well, how did you make the contacts and connections in order to become a candidate for this position?
So funny enough, this the role at the Italian luxury fashion house, I don't know whether it was a mix of luck and knowing the right people, or it's just like the timing was right. So during my placement year at St. Martin's, it was a year of like work experience. So I was actually in Florence on a trip with one of my friends, and I was in Florence on a, God, what would you call it when you're on a trip with university?
School trip.
So I was on a school trip with university.
had a school trip to Italy, by the way. I'm making a formal complaint to my uni.
I went, I think it was, we went to see, it was Pitti Filati. So that's the big knitwear expo. So we did a trip from St. Martin's. We took a few students over there to see the factories and like the exhibitions. And whilst I was there, actually, one of my friend's sisters, her name's Charlotte, actually, was in Florence. So we met up and had dinner. And, you know, she was working for Ralph Lauren at the time. And I was just speaking to her and saying how much, you know, obviously I love fashion and like I love Italian fashion houses, and the fashion house in particular. You know, I mentioned a few names, and little did I know, when she got back to London about a month or two later, she actually got a job at that particular fashion house, which was one of my favorite ones. And they told her, I could get an intern in, because, you know, the office is growing, you need some help, get an intern from Central St. Martin's. So they didn't say to what, look for an intern from any other university. They were very specific with saying, you have to have an intern from Central St. Martin's. So I think that was either my lucky break or, you know, the stars had aligned or something. So she reached out to me and said, I know how much you love this brand. Would you like to come and do an internship with me for a few months? So obviously I was like over the moon, because at the time I was doing an internship with a British designer, again, in another freezing cold studio. And I was shivering every day. I just don't know what it is, why these places don't have any heating. And it was so miserable. But I was like, no, I've got to do this. And then this actually came up. So that was like my lucky break. And I went over to the fashion house. And that's, I think, where it all started.
I mean, it, of course, there is an element of luck involved. But I think that a lot of I just really can't stress enough to people starting off in their careers how valuable it is to reach out to people and to talk to people, just like asking people about their day, having a genuine interest in what people do, because you find out things about them, like where they work and if they're an intern, just stuff like you're not going out there to and giving, I suppose, networking a bad name, kind of like being a fishy person. It's having that genuine interest in people and the industry, which you obviously had. And so there's that kind of like passion and wanting to, you know, communicate, talk to people, combined with your stars lining up. So that's a really nice story that you have there.
But you know what also happened? I applied for an internship at Topshop. I got, I think, to stage two or stage three, and I didn't get the job, and I was so upset. Like, I was crying my eyes out, and I was like, I can't believe I didn't get it. I was like, I worked so hard. But then little did I know that this conversation I'd had in Florence with Charlotte would have turned into an actual internship at one of my, at my favorite luxury Italian fashion house. But again, as you said, it was about the conversation, talking to people. You know, you might not know, it might not be relevant now, but later on down the line, you know, that's happened to me so many times where I've made, built relationships, spoken to people, you know, when I was at university, when I was first started out, to now, it's really helped my business. They're more likely to choose me as a, as an agency over another one, just because I've, you know, I've had this relationship, they've spoken to me 10 years ago, and they have that trust in you. So I always say building relationships is very key and essential, I think, to people starting off. I say, and don't build, not fake relationships, but, you know, build genuine ones and be genuinely interested. Don't be here today and then not tomorrow, because they're not long term.
Yeah. You're building your reputation, I suppose. And you don't want to build a reputation that comes across, well, you don't want to build a reputation that is fake.
Yeah, basically don't build your fake followers.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you for sharing that. I think that's really helpful advice. So what was the reason that you decided to pursue a career in PR, I suppose, specifically?
So I think I kind of, as I said, I fell into it. I wanted to be a designer. I studied design. I did my final collections at university and at college, you know, on a show. And then I kind of, as I said, fell into this internship where, you know, this role as like a celebrity PR didn't exist before. So the Italian fashion house that I worked with were actually one of the only offices that had a separate celebrity press office, where we just dressed celebrities for red carpet events, music videos, tour, front rows. And I kind of, as much as like I like the designing aspect of fashion, but there was styling involved and the business side. So I think, you know, me being brought up in a family business, that side of it that I loved, but I also love like the fashion, styling, and the creative side. So it was a good match. I think I kind of fell into this role, but I loved it so much that I was like, okay, I think this is what my destiny is. This is what I want to pursue. And even now when I look back at it, I was like, I'm so glad I didn't end up being a designer. I love the styling and creative side. I still have that side, but I love the business side more.
So would you advise, I suppose, people who are interested in the corporate side of fashion and in the creative side of fashion, and who do want to kind of like merge the two, would you advise after graduating from like high school to go into like university or college, I suppose, and do arts, or learn business side of things first? Business and marketing?
I didn't learn the business and marketing side. I actually learned the design side of it. But maybe because I had it as a family background, it helped. But I also think, because fashion is so vast now, you should try all the different areas. Like, try an intern in, like, you know, the press office or in the design studio or the showroom. There's lots of different areas. And then I guess you can kind of figure out which route you want to take. As I said, I thought I wanted to be a designer. It was all about me being a designer. But I fell into the PR side and a bit of the styling side, which I'm glad I did, because that's, like, shaped my whole career path now.
Yeah.
I'd say try, if you're unsure of what you want to do, try a few different aspects of like fashion, from the marketing to PR to the design, and then you can figure them out.
So what is your top tip for aspiring fashion and celebrity PR entrepreneurs when completing an internship at a luxury fashion house?
I would say my top tip would be, make as many long-lasting relationships as you can. Go out there, meet people, you know, try and get some work experience, continue getting work experience in different places, build your network, build your contacts, travel if you can, if you have the means to travel, you know, travel to like the top cities like Paris, Milan, I mean New York, like, if you're lucky enough to, then do that. And also just don't, like, be a bit more open-minded, don't stick to one path, especially nowadays. Also keep researching and reading, like, you know, you should always be reading like the Business of Fashion every day, and all, you know, so there's so much knowledge. In my days, there was no social media or Instagram, or those, I think we just about had online. And that was all a bit new. So it was always just like magazines and newspapers. So I used to like get the newspapers and like read the newspaper, read all the fashion articles on there. I used to subscribe to Draper's Record, where you have all the industry news of like which company's gone bust, like who's taken over, which design house is, you know, the new and upcoming thing. So all that knowledge that I gained over the years, I think has also helped me a lot more on my career path. And I think young kids these days, like, they forget about that. It's a very much like now social media pictures, that's it. But I was like, you need the experience and the skills and the knowledge, which I think a lot of them forget.
Yeah, definitely. You need the substance, and you need to know the foundations before you I suppose are qualified to, you know, get involved in the stuff that's being pushed out there in publications and editorial things. It's can't just one, two, skip a few and then make it to fashion shows. I don't know.
Exactly. They're all, you know, like going to fashion shows, like you need, I always like want to know about the designer, the history behind the designer, the inspiration, how they started. Like, I always find it so interesting to see how that designer started off, like where they came from, what their family was, what made them, you know, become a designer and take these students, what their inspiration's from. Because you can see it in their work. It's like, yeah, you know, it all kind of comes together.
Yeah, I really enjoy learning about, well, you know, the creative industry, fashion and luxury brands in particular. But I really, because I'm a law student and I'm going to be starting at a commercial law firm in a few years' time, I like to combine like that passion with like my hobbies and interests. And I love listening to the Business of Fashion podcast. Like, that's one of my favorite things to
listen to. Yeah, I do too.
I can pick up so many things I'm interested in, and then yeah, it kind of like gives me energy to learn more about the law and business, and I've got my fashion fix, I suppose. So, yeah, highly recommend the Business of Fashion podcast. And it sounds like a great publication that you were talking about the takeovers and the acquisitions of
I think it was Draper's Record, actually. I think it still exists, I'm not quite sure now, but Draper's Records was the go-to magazine for the industry experts, and you'd read all the stories in there, and it was a lot more business than creative fashion, but I know everyone always read in there, and they always wanted to be featured in there, because that was like the publication back in the day, before we had social media. I mean, you'd have like the Vogues and the L's, that was obviously very editorial, but this was all about the industry and how the industry was doing and who's doing what and who's producing and manufacturing most clothes and which factories have moved to different places, which is the boring side, but it's not, you know, you never hear about that these days.
Yeah, exactly. So there are, I suppose, free methods and ways for aspiring fashion entrepreneurs to learn about these things before making a decision to study, you know, whatever they want to study. So I will put links to these podcasts and editorials in the show notes of this episode if anybody wants to check that out. No filter. So moving on to your current position, I was wondering if you could please explain what your role as outer mode specialist at a couture fashion house involves.
So that role, I consult for an Italian fashion house with their couture collection. So Actually, it's a very new role. My role is to bring in the South Asian community in and expose them to the couture altermodal world. So I'm like building these relationships with clients, with press, stylists, sort of bridging the gap between like the West and the East. So it's a role that I've kind of also developed myself and, you know, built different strategies around it. And I guess it's just my expertise and skills that I've built over the years. And my, you know, my black book of contacts that this role has kind of come up.
So how do you make contacts in a different market? Is you're talking about, you know, your little black book. Is it just about making these relationships, building your reputation, you know, that 6 degrees of separation, knowing who to talk to in order to make connections in different markets? Is that how it works?
To a degree. And then I guess I'm quite social as a person as well. So I meet a lot of different people along the line. I think, like, for instance, like when I'm at the Cannes Film Festival and, you know, there's so many people there, like from film to music to fashion to art. And then, you know, people from all around the world. This is, you know, a lot of the Indian celebrities, the Bollywood celebrities in particular, are all at the Cannes Film Festival. And then obviously I think, you know, because I'm Indian as well, I grew up watching their films. So, you know, I was always interested in it. And one by one, like I met them or I dressed them or I met a stylist or their manager. And then my network just grew and grew and grew. And at that time, it was just, I just made these friends as such, like within the industry. I wasn't working with any of them. It was just like a passion that I had. And, you know, we just sit, we'd have drinks. I'd know the managers and we'd just talk about like Indian fashion, not even like Western fashion, Indian fashion, saris, and obviously because I grew up in that world. But now, brands, as I say, international brands are very much focused in the South Asian market. They want to dress as celebrities. They want to, you know, open shops up there, like do digital tour work. So I think so I think it was all the connections that I'd made a few years ago within the different countries. And I guess also that knowing them and someone will introduce you to another person, and then through that I'd meet another person. And so it's a bit like a chain where you meet one and then you meet the rest. Because also it's a very small industry as well. So I think once you've met one or two, you kind of meet all of them, or they know about you and, you know, the word gets round. That's definitely for India and the South Asian market. But Europe, like Italy, Paris, I guess it's a little bit similar, where once you've met one stylist or an agent, they kind of like travel around Europe so that you're exposed to like more and more people, and then your network just grows and grows.
What would you say the main difference is working with clients in the South Asian market versus the
West market?
Yeah,
I think this is a bit of a struggle that we have quite often. Clients in the South Asian market, India in particular, have a different work-life balance and a different way of working. It's very much suited to the South Asian side. Whereas the Western side, again, you know, I have a different way of working. So I think for me, it's very much I am the bridge, because I understand the South Asian market and I'm from the Western market, so I understand that. So I'm like the communicator in between. Even like the simplest things in, you know, in South Asia, they do email, but a lot of it's on WhatsApp. Like I'll wake up in the morning with like 100 messages on WhatsApp. But that's their culture. That's how they work. Everything's instant. And there's no work-life balance. Like they can call at 11 o'clock at night, or they can, you know, they message like 3 a.m, but it's just the way that they work. Like work-life is all one. Whereas I think in the West, I wouldn't call anyone after 9 o'clock or anything about work. I wake up until, you know, I'm at the office again in the morning. There's a different cultural way of working. So I think that was a lot of like loss in translation that brands and celebrities have. So I think once you master that, then I can help brands get into that market, and then celebrities like the other way.
It sounds great to be able to work with such a variety of clientele and different cultures. It must keep things interesting and very inspiring, I guess.
And then, I mean, someone like India has like over 1 billion people. It's a huge following over there as well, like, you know, compared to the UK. And they have, you know, Bollywood have mass following. They literally, I feel like the country runs on Bollywood and cricket. So, you know, and they worship these celebrities. So, you know, if for a luxury brand, for a Bollywood celebrity to wear, you know, your dress or your shoes or the bag is massive. Like, it completely sells out. The return on investment is very good.
Excellent. So before we go on to CJM publicity, you must tell me, what is your favourite Bollywood film?
Oh my God, my favourite one. It has
the one that you've watched the most, totally like binged on.
You know what I love is the Sanjay Leela Bhansali films. Devdas for sure, one of my favourites, with Shah Rukh Khan.
Okay, I'm going to check that out because I've only seen a handful of Bollywood films. So, yeah, any recommendations that you have for me, send them my way because they are great. I forget how good they are once.
They're like musicals. I mean, Sanjay Leela Bhansali films are like incredible. The sets and, you know, the art and the story behind it and the costume. He's really, you know, puts his all into every single film. I just like one a year, but you know, we're always waiting for that one film to come out because you know it's going to be magical.
Yeah. So can you tell us about CJM Publicity by telling us about the services that it provides and who your clients are?
Yeah. So CJM Publicity started off with just working with brands. So we do celebrity dressing, celebrity partnerships, front rows for shows, for fashion shows, for brands, event guest lists, meaning like VIP, socialites, press, all from a brand side. But now CJM Publicity is kind of, you know, we've got different departments. So I'm growing my talent side, which is, you know, I have Sonam Kapoor, one of my clients, and she's been my client from day one. I have Ananya Billa. I guess this is, I kind of am the pioneer in the South Asian talent. I guess, again, because I understand both sides from like South Asia and India to the UK and the West. So again, I'm the right type of person, the bridge who kind of brings in international brands and celebrities together for partnerships. And I've just actually taken on the first ever South Asian non-binary singer, Leah Kalyan. So I very much champion the LGBTQ community, as well as like, you know, females. So I feel like it's a very niche agency that I have, but it's much needed now, you know, with like diversity, the women empowerment, and you know, I'm a champion like for all that. So I was like, if no one else is doing it, then I'm going to do it. It's part of my publicity company. And then I also have like a styling leg as well. So sometimes I style celebrities for events, for red carpets, for shoots. And that is kind of just something I do for fun because I just enjoy styling. If there's styling there without pressure, then I love doing that.
So can you tell us about the logistics of VIP dressing? What's involved and are there any business risks attached to it?
Quite a lot actually, because with VIP and celebrity dressing, unless there's a paid partnership, there's never any guarantee. So for that, you know, the whole thing is I could build relationships with the stylists, with the agents and the celebrities themselves, so they're more likely to wear the brand that I'm working with or promoting over another brand. Because it's happened many times where we've got clothes, we've done a fitting, you know, the tailors have been there, we've altered the outfit, all ready to go, and last minute the celebrity or somebody has told them they don't like the dress and they switch and they put another dress on and they're out on the carpet. And that's the biggest risk, because besides, you know, time, energy, money, all goes to waste. That's probably the biggest risk. But when the celebrity does wear the dress, then it's amazing because you get so much press. And, you know, if it was the right person with the right dress on, you know, it'll be all over the papers, front page, all over social media. A lot of things that I've done in the past as well, they've been, I ended up being iconic looks. I know, bless her, Amy Winehouse had a dress for the Brit Awards. It was like the tartan corset with the leopard skirt. Like I put that together and I remember that same dress. And it became like an iconic look. Everyone remembers Amy winning all those awards with that outfit on. But again, you know, it was never a paid partnership. It was a relationship we had with her and her team and the stylist. And that's why she wore the look in the end over another designer. But I have many of those like memories from celebrity dressing that I've done in the past.
What with, you know, like Instagram being so massive these days, and celebrities, you know, always being photographed at these events and it going onto Instagram. Are paid partnerships more prominent? Like, are there more of them these days?
Yes, I think 100% there's definitely a lot more paid partnerships now than they were. When I first started out working in celebrity office, there was never paid partnerships, unless you were actually, you know, in a campaign where an advert, then that's a whole, you know, a different thing completely. But yeah, paid partnerships did not exist. It was more about relationships, relationship building. Also because you like the brand, you like the clothes, and you kind of, you know, became friends with everybody within the brand, and you know, it was your go-to brand, and it was just nice organic relationships. And you know, like you'd go out and you'd have actually there's more gifting, so you know, we'd gift handbags and things, but it was up to the celebrity, it was up to the agent, you know, if they wanted to carry it or they didn't want. There's never any pressure. But I think now, also because there's so many celebrities, and now we have the whole influencer culture, and I guess they can see now like the return on investment with an influencer promoting a product. So I guess if they can charge, they will.
So in situations where there's no paid partnership and you've got free reign, how do you decide what to dress somebody in for, say, a red carpet event?
I guess this is something I know when I have the skills, and I've done it for many years, that I know, for instance, the Cannes Film Festival, I know the type of clothes that, you know, they want to wear. It is very much gowns, like long gowns. It's very, you know, it's the French Riviera, and it's, you know, there's a history of the Cannes Film Festival, because, you know, it's like a statement gown there. Whereas I think if it's like an event in London, or you know, the opening of something, like I wouldn't put the celebrity in a big fluffy gown with feathers on. It would be, you know, even like a cute trouser suit or a little cocktail dress. And also depends, as I said, on the area. Like London's a lot cooler, whereas like, you know, red carpet at the Oscars is like, you know, all over the top with your like best dressed and, you know, custom made outfits with the jewelry. Again, jewelry is another one that I've worked with a lot, with big brands such as Chopard. So that whole side of like the jewelry world and the celebrity placement is also like a big thing.
I mean, I suppose that the jewelry complements the outfit, you know.
Yeah,
so it sounds natural that that the jewelry side would be quite heavily involved in the person's outfit.
Yeah.
What about if somebody wanted to wear a big fluffy gown at a London premiere? Would you work with them to find kind of like some middle ground, some compromise? Or
I do struggle with that. I try not to sugarcoat, and I'd give them reasons why not, and then give them examples. I'm like, well, you can wear this big fluffy gown if you want to, but this is the festival, this is the red carpet, this is what other, you know, people in the past have worn. I was like, you will get negative press. I was like, that's not what we're aiming at. We want positive press, and we want people to admire what you're wearing, and you know, to be in magazines and reposts. We don't want you to turn into a meme. I'm actually quite blunt with them. I was like, this is, from my experience, this is what will happen if you wear this dress. Whereas I guess, because I've been in the industry for quite a long time now, so I know what's going to happen. Whereas I don't know, someone starting out might not have that experience. And it's also the thing of like a celebrity, they kind of want to make the celebrity happy. You know, and they would wear that big fluffy dress.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like your Central Saint Martin's the teachers kind of like being quite firm with you. You may not have known at the time, but you know, a couple of years later, you're maybe using the skills that were taught to you, like the soft skills that your teachers 100%. Were using on you, on your clients. So I think it just goes to show, although you may not think that something is like crucial at that time, or may not be serving a purpose, you know, as you were saying a little bit earlier on in the show, if you keep an open mind and think that it may be beneficial or maybe some use later down the line, keep an open mind, it is definitely worth it.
I don't sugarcoat it, as they say. No sugarcoating.
Keep it real. When you have a firm hand, you are more respected. If you're somewhat of a pushover, they're just, you know, do it again and not respect you as much, and perhaps not work with you in the future because, you know, they might not think that you take control. So I think that the way that you work is very, very sensible.
Okay. And also your
name, professional.
Yeah, professional, and your name's attached to it as well. So if a celebrity makes a mistake, the fingers they point straight at the team, like straight away. Not knowing what goes on behind the scenes, but you know, everyone's like, oh, she looks terrible, what has she done, how did the stylist let her walk out like this? So it's like there's a whole team behind a celebrity. It's not just like one person out of thin air.
Well, thank you for sending that message. I think that's very, very good to know. So what about the logistics of creating brand partnerships for your clients? How do you decide which celebrity is a good fit for the brand, or is it the brand that comes to you and wants a particular celebrity?
So it's a bit of both. So if I'm working with a brand, we'll start off by, you know, having a meeting with the brand, getting all the requirements in. So for instance, you know, they're launching, I don't know, a bracelet or something, and they're launching which country they're launching, whether it's UK, what's their audience. And what we do is we'd go back with that information and do a sort of casting. So we'd look at all the different celebrities, influencers, who we think would suit this brand, like ticks all the boxes. And then we present that to the client, to the brand, saying, this is what we think, like, these are the people, you know, who are cool right now, who are hot right now, who are, you know, will give you the return on investment. And also then they give us their budgets as well. So certain celebrities we know, you know, they're in the A bracket, or they're in the B bracket, or they're in the C bracket. And then we filter it down with the client. You know, do you have enough budget just to go with the one A-lister where we can spend all the budget and have that big global name? Or would you prefer to do a few from list B, which could be, you know, four names from that, but they'll be, you know, like constant. We can produce more content. They'll be in different countries. Or you do like list C, where they're like micro influencers, but we do about 20 of them, so people keep seeing the bracelet pop up on their Instagram because they see everyone wearing it. So there's different levels and different budgets is like how I normally work with a paid partnership with a brand or a celebrity.
That's really interesting to know. So ultimately you are providing the package and the options that you think could work for this client, knowing what business that they're in and knowing budgets.
But from the experience within the business,
and then they decide and take it from there.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously it's like also up to me for my knowledge from being in the industry and being around people. So that's why they pay me for my services, because they know, you know, I know what's going on. I have my foot on the pedal. I know, you know, this person's like a new upcoming artist. You know, I know he or she is going to be huge soon, or this sports person is, you know, won the Olympic medal. So that's another one we'd put in. But nowadays, actually, it's not just music and fashion. It is also like sports, entrepreneurs. So brands do like a diversity of casting. It's not just like the one actress and that's it. They like other areas and other industries. So Stephanie, I could have you on my casting board next time.
I will not turn you down. But this kind of subject topic does interest me. Are brands and your clients looking for celebrities or influencers who have a high following and relevant to, you know, their bracelet, or are they just looking for a high following? Is there middle ground?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a, I think before, when brands didn't quite understand the difference between an influencer with a high following, or it was like the quality of their content and their followers. So someone could have like a million followers, but if you'd like look into their statistics, you can see actually most of their following is like male and from like, I don't know, it's like South Africa. So that's not very relevant to the UK market. Where we have this actually, what do you call it, this option on Instagram, for instance, you can go into the analytics, and a lot of brands, like, we ask for their analytics, their following, whether it's like male or female, the age gap. So now it's very business savvy, rather than like, oh, they've got a million followers, let's just put them, because they can have a million, but they're the wrong followers. And now there's this new breed of like tastemakers. So for instance, someone like me, I'm not an influencer, but you know, I post about things in my business and my work, but they see the relevance of the actual people who follow me. Actually, I'm probably more likely to buy a product than an influencer. So, you know, I have celebrities on me, I have like business personnel follow me, I have like editors and stylists. So like my actual network is very interesting to like, you know, and normal influencers who's just posting out clothes. Yeah, so this is a new breed of influencers. I call them tastemakers.
Tastemakers. I've not heard that before. Yeah. It just sounds like you have a genuine following, though. And it kind of reminds me of a recent makeup line that's gone under. And when I was researching as to why they went under, mm-hmm. I was looking at who they used to promote their product. And I was quite surprised at the influencers that they had brought on, because it kind of like they weren't anything to do with their brand. And it just seemed to me like they were just trying to get hold of anybody that was popular and they thought might sell the product. But I just thought it goes to show that nowadays people are quite savvy to pay partnerships. Yeah. And they're probably very aware that this person probably doesn't use their makeup, they're just being paid for it. I don't think anybody likes being sold to.
No, so I think we're all a lot more savvy now. The audience is a lot more savvy. They know if it's a, like, obviously they have to also put a hashtag like pay partnership or ad, but they know when they're being sold advertise a product that's just been paid for. So I think there's a lot that goes into casting these days, and there's a lot more pressure on the content creators because they have to promote products in a certain way. Yes, they're being paid, but after it's been posted, they have to give the brand analytics back to them, saying, you know, what's been the return on investment, how many have they sold. So it's a job in that. It's not just pretty pictures anymore.
Yeah, it does sound very complex, the whole world of influencing and social media marketing and everything like that. Definitely something to kind of like follow as the legislation goes on, I suppose, because it's very interesting and very current. So what has been one of your most memorable digital influencer campaigns? Because I know that you're involved in that as well. And how do you keep ahead of the ever-changing digital kind of marketing campaigns?
I've done quite a few different digital campaigns. I think one of the most successful or kind of fun was when I worked on the brand Reserved. It's a Polish brand. I don't know if you might have seen the store on Oxford Street. It was the first time the brand was coming to the UK, coming to London, and they've opened a huge store on Oxford Street where Kate Moss was actually the face of the brand at the time. So leading up to that, I think we had a 3-month plan where we worked with various influencers, like 10 influencers that we did partnerships with, where they'd post about the product. So every influencer who we worked with was like given a load of product where they'd go out and they'd shoot it, and we'd actually schedule in when they would shoot each, so when they would post each image. So one will be on like Thursday at 2, one will be like at 4 o'clock, and then Friday at 7. So it was actually flooding everyone's feeds with a constant reserve. So everyone's like, oh, what's this brand? I see this person wearing it, I see that person wearing it. And then leading up to that, we worked towards the store launch where Kate was the face of the brand, where she had so they had all these like billboards and posters all around Oxford Street, and we actually made the influencers go and take selfies outside them. So it was like, oh, what's this thing? Like, we built the hype. And it was absolutely amazing. Even people who don't work in fashion, or like, you know, they're working, my friends in banking or like, or like doctors, they're like, oh, we've heard of this like Kate Moss brand, we've heard of this brand. Like, it was literally coming up like on their feeds, and they heard about it in the paper. So I think that was a very successful partnership campaign that I worked on. Definitely the biggest one. They did put a lot of money behind it, but they definitely got the results that were needed.
It sounds like doing a campaign like that would just, God, it must give you so much energy and create so much buzz. Yes. It must give you, I mean, it would give me such an adrenaline rush to see all of your planning and your strategizing to to see it crystallize and be standing outside of the shop watching people take selfies. It must give you a really good, great job
satisfaction. It's a good euphoric feeling. I think at the end of it, after we did it all, we're like, wow, this was like amazing. It was huge, like absolutely huge. I remember like Oxford Street tube station also had like all these pictures of reserve all the way up the escalator. And I remember opening day, we had like Vogue dancers outside on Oxford Street. It was amazing, crowds of people outside. And, you know, we didn't really do that much, but everyone's like, oh my God, what's this crowd out here outside the store? And everyone waiting to get in and buy the product. And it was very exciting. There was a lot of planning, meticulous planning, from scheduling to getting clothes and like getting things approved from the designers. And also it was a Polish brand. So it wasn't like, the team was like based out in Poland. So we'd have to go over and like meet the teams and like discuss them. And sort of, it was like all done hand in hand, but it was a huge three to four month build up before like the store opened.
So how do you come up with, or keep coming up with, innovative campaigns of this sort?
So we have like brainstorming sessions all the time. Like, we'll try and set aside some time and be like, okay, right, what can we do? I mean, we see what people have done in the past and what's been successful, but it's literally like sitting and brainstorming for like an hour or so, like, right, we could do this, we could do that, and we just like hash it all out and then see what's actually viable. And then, you know, I had my team like go back out, have a break of the weekend, come back, and I was like, okay, have you thought of anything? And I think it just develops. The more you talk, the more you meet people, the more you go out to places, or they've seen a cool place, or they've seen a certain person like perform, or, you know, they've seen this artist, and we're like, okay, right, let's see how we can bring them in like into our campaigns and present them to the client.
Excellent. So taking like lots of inspiration from different things in the past, the present, and communicating with your team, and taking little short breaks in order to
digest it all.
Yeah, exactly. They hear people come up with their greatest and most creative ideas in the shower, which I think is probably quite true. I'm a shower thinker.
Shower thinker is good. I as well.
And I think a lot of my ideas come when I'm lying in bed as well, which I try to always keep a notepad next to me, but that never seems to happen. I've just typed things into my phone, which probably is not good for when I'm trying to get to sleep, to be like, oh, wait, I know, by my light.
It always happens, isn't it, when you're trying to get to sleep and then like you get this idea, I'm like, oh my God, like, then I'll be thinking about it whilst I'm like sleeping. Ideas come to me in my dreams often. Sometimes I remember them, sometimes I don't. But I dream about things a lot. So I'm wondering, right. I was like, what was I eating the night before? Like, how did this dream happen?
So what should young entrepreneurs know about launching a brand, development agency, before, you know, they set off on and embark on, you know, creating their own agency?
I'd always say, I mean, it's great to have your own business and start it off, but I wouldn't give up your day job yet until you can actually sustain your everyday living costs from your own agency. Maybe if you can, maybe do a whole part-time thing, have your everyday job, and then work on clients as consultants on the side, and then start building your agency and your brands from that. And that's kind of how I did it as well. When I first started, I had one or two brands. I didn't even quite know how the business side worked, but I learned on the job as well. And it's also
would you say they had a strategy in place? At least the guidelines anyway.
I want to say yes, but also no. I did kind of learn on the job from the early years. From what I knew, and then I guess I researched of how other agencies kind of work. I was now I have to do this, and there's this department, and this is the way. I didn't actually sit down and write up a business plan. I kind of just have this all in my head and kind of saw what worked and which direction, I need to go in to develop my business. So I think now, after a lot of experience and talking to people and having mentors, has been successful for me for my agency. If you can get a mentor, it's very important. I had a mentor as well. Sadly, he's passed away recently. But I had a mentor who, I always went to to ask questions, or, I'd be okay, this client wants to work with me, what do you think? And, he'd point me in the right direction and say, no, do this, meet this person, think about this better, what's the long-term plan? So, and, he was someone with experience. So I always went to that, my mentor, for experience and the, inspiration behind my brand. So mentoring 100%.
How did you get funding in place? I know you spoke about, maintain a full-time job before you venture off and establish your own business. But say, for example, somebody was ready to make that break, but they didn't yet have enough money to, put
money behind things. I mean, nowadays there's lots of ways of getting funding. There's lots of grants, especially for new startups, a lot of VC funds. I didn't get any funding. I kind of self-funded myself because I was working at the same time and then built my agency on the side, and now it's fully self-funded. But there are a lot of funds that help young startups, especially again Shift from the mentorship program that I work on. They have the profits from their sales they give to startup, especially young entrepreneurial women. And again, even the smaller things write up a business plan. I know I don't write one, but I do suggest that they do have some sort of business plan together and propose it to people, and you never know who's going to be okay, great, I think this is amazing, I'll give you the money for it. And nowadays it's a lot of people want to invest in smaller businesses and help them grow. So I think if you have a bit of a plan, talk to people, talk to mentors, and then I think you can easily get funding that way.
I mean, a lot of people that I've spoken to on the show haven't had a business plan when setting up, so that seems to be a very common trend that I've seen. But in terms of funding, perhaps write up a business plan, as you were saying, and take it around, see if you can get some kind of investment. I suppose there's banks as well that will offer
banks will lend. I think even the government, the UK government has a fund. I mean, if you want to be savvy, you can go over to San Francisco and, ask one of the big VCs. I mean, but I think they'll want to see our whole business plan.
Then you might need a business plan for that.
Yeah, I think for that one, you might need a full-on business plan because they want to see where that money's going. But, if you're about to open up a big business. But even, just reaching out to people, reaching out to brands, you never know where you can get funding from. I mean, I've been offered it in the past as well from people. I was like, oh my God, I had no idea that you wanted to invest in the business. But I wasn't at that stage where I needed the funding to grow. I was self-funding. The business was funding itself. So I was lucky in that way. But there's people out there. If anybody needs any help, I'm sure I can point them in the right direction.
Excellent. So it takes us back to talking to people and communicating with people and just learning what other people do and talking to people about what you do. You just never know what's going to come of it. So how do you win and retain business?
So my business, actually, lucky enough, I don't advertise, but a lot of it is word of mouth. People who I've worked in the past have recommended me, and then someone else has recommended me, and it's kind of just I've built my business on recommendations. So again, it's very important for those long-lasting relationships that you build earlier on in life. They're all the clients that are now like have their own brands, or they're celebrities, you know, they come to me like, oh my god, like, we'd love to join you, like, please look after us, I know how you work. And yeah, also you have to be meticulous with your work. It's all well and good building the relationships, but you also have to be able to put the work in. Like, you, it's not just going to happen. You have to work very hard. I mean, that, I think I forgot to say that you have to actually work hard. It's not going to just come on a plate. The late nights and the hours and they're like the no weekends, that's a no-brainer. It's like constantly around the clock. And then now, I guess, now that I have social media and Instagram, I post a lot about events that I've done, clients that I work with, experiences. So it's a lot more visual, so you can, it's like my CV but in pictures. I have a small website, so I get inquiries from websites as well. But I think mainly it's word of mouth is how we get all this.
Yeah. I've noticed that many people have said it's word of mouth and building your reputation. There's just no denying it. It's so important to put 110% effort all the time. I know it's really difficult to constantly have that energy, but it just, you can't make the first impression twice, can you? And I
know exactly,
it's really true. You don't want to meet somebody just one time and you're annoyed about something and you're letting it come off, and then that person just presuming that's what you like all the time, and then saying that to somebody else. I think it's really important to
You have to build that. You have to kind of build that poker face, as they say, no matter what's going on. Just like I learned to do that. I kind of like detach myself from it, whatever's the trauma or like the stress. Where I was like, I put it aside for a while. I'll go do the meeting, put my brave face on, put my red lipstick on, do it, and I'll come back home and then I'll have a cry over it. Yeah. So I think it's just trying to separate your actual feelings and your emotions and your life, your real life, from the work life. So it's getting that work life balance as well, especially when you run your own business, your business is your life. But I think trying to separate that is like the key, which I'm learning as well. It doesn't come easily. It comes after time and experience, for sure.
And I think it is only natural that we have a cry every once in a while, because it's tough and it's only human nature to feel sad sometimes. I do think well, for me personally, I like to just ride it out. I just like sit in my bedroom for a day or two and watch like trashy films and just get over it, because I do always come out of it and then I feel energized to go again.
There's always light at the end of the tunnel, and I guess just to do things that kind of take a step back and make you happy, like have your list of things that make you happy, like watching funny films or like having a massage or just pamper yourself for a while and just go through that feeling, because you will come out of it afterwards. It's just accepting what it is at the time, and then just working through it.
So we've spoken about challenges of working, the logistics of VIP dressing and working with different markets. What has been the biggest challenge overall as a business owner for you?
I guess I've had a lot of challenges. I feel like every day is a challenge. The uncertainty of the business, definitely during COVID, like I all my clients were like, we've got to go on hold. I had one client, I was like, oh my goodness, what's happening to the business? Like, because we were unsure, we didn't know what was going to happen. And the first thing that people dropped was like the PR and the marketing side. And my whole business runs on PR and marketing. So that was very challenging, which made me think, I was like, do I need to rethink my whole business, my whole career path? Like, what am I doing? I was like, the whole lockdown, I was like stressing the whole time. So that's definitely one of the biggest challenges. And I was looking at other areas. So I think that's how my agency has developed from it, is now it's not just one track minded, just working with brands. I work with talent. I do the styling side. I'm going to get into wedding styling, you know, a bit more like digital, the metaverse. So there's like all different avenues. I don't think nowadays you just stick to one. I think you need a few different avenues with your business.
No filter. I'm glad you brought up the metaverse, because it's a great kind of like segue into my next question. How would you like luxury fashion to transpire into the metaverse?
So I'm slightly obsessed with the whole metaverse at the moment. It's very interesting, and it's definitely, you know, the way forward. It's quite hard to digest and understand what it is, but I think it takes a bit of time to kind of understand, like, you know, what the metaverse is. It's like kind of Earth, but in a digital format. And luxury brands are working a lot with NFTs and the metaverse, building their digital stores, like via Sandbox or buying land in the metaverse. And then I guess people like us can build our own NFT or avatars, and we can go shopping in the stores. So in a way, it's kind of, you don't have to get up and get off your couch and go and try outfits on. You kind of have your own avatar body, which is great, and you can try all these things on, see what works, and then you can actually maybe buy them in real life, and, you know, there you go. But there's also the whole side of NFTs, which is very interesting, where you can make a lot of money off it on you know, owning an NFT, and especially if it's a popular NFT, and, you know, like Bathing Ape or something, which is like iconic. Once you sell it on, the resale value like increases, especially if you were the first owner of this NFT. Every time it gets sold on, you get royalties from it. So I think these, for instance, like the NFT sneakers and like the bags and things, I think this whole world is going to grow and grow and grow more. And I think we need to learn about it. I think they need to teach it in schools as well, because it's definitely the way forward.
Yeah, I agree with you. I do think it is going to grow to the point where it's just going to be just become part of the world as we kind of know it. And I do think it's going to come along quite quickly as well. Like, I think that you and I will definitely be around to transpire into, you know, the present day when we get there. But yeah, it is difficult to explain what it is, because it could be, you know, everything and anything. I like to think that we have these VR goggles on or something like that, and, you know, call up our mates and all arrange to go somewhere, using air quotes there. And we can, you know, choose our virtual outfits that we want to wear, that, you know, we went virtually shopping for, but, you know, in the NFT or something like that. So that's how I envision it happening.
There's also actually yesterday during Paris Fashion Week, this brand called Copperoni, they had Bella Hadid, and I don't know if you saw it, they used this like spray painting technique, which like put her whole, like sprayed on this whole dress, which dries like quickly, instantly, and then, you know, she kind of like folded the shoulders over, and then that was like the dress, and then she walked, and like, you know, it just happened. So I also think this is some sort of metaverse digital link with the spray painting, where maybe you can like do 3D printing from the metaverse into the real world. So I think there's lots of different things in fashion, which is very like innovative and interesting.
You know, there's a documentary on Netflix about the future of fashion, and it talks about how it will kind of, have you seen Clueless, where Cher typed in what she wants to wear?
Oh my god, I love it. I've always wanted it since I first watched it.
I know, how stupid of me asking, have you seen it? Well, my question should have been, was when was the last time you watched it? And if it wasn't last
probably night, like last week.
What were you thinking? But yeah, this Future of Fashion episode on Netflix talks about people will be able to, you know, type in what they want to wear and it will just get made, but all ESG kind of friendly. And then it will be disposable again. After they've worn it, and it will go into, like,
that would be incredible. Like I'd love that, and you know, it's good for the planet, seeing as we're all destroying our planet, so especially with all the landfills and the, you know, all the extra clothes and everything, which I buy a lot more vintage now. I'm forever, like, I buy so much of Vestiaire, and I buy, like, you know, secondhand and like secondhand designer clothes and everything, because it's like, this is ridiculous that what we're doing in fashion, and, you know, all this, because I'm not the biggest fan of fast fashion. Like, I don't buy fast fashion, and I don't. Yes, it's great for, you know, some people like it, but for me, I'm a bit more environmentally concerned. So I'm also like reusing clothes, like, you know, platforms like Vestiaire, and actually, what Balenciaga are doing now as well. They're like, all your archive Balenciaga products, or clothes or shoes or bags, you can bring into the store. You can either exchange it for new products, or you can have your money back for it, which is amazing. So it's like a whole recycling where, you know, there's no waste.
Yeah.
I wonder how many other brands will take this on.
So do you think that will be the future of luxury fashion?
I hope so. I hope it will be the future of luxury fashion, because I just hate all the waste. I think definitely the metaverse for sure, because it's growing and growing even more. So I think no doubt they will have like digital fashion. But then also people want to fill clothes and wear clothes. So I think this whole reuse, recycle of fashion is 100% going to be a way forward.
Yeah, I do think it's very interesting. I know that Chanel have created this very exclusive range to some of their clientele. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that kind of movement, making things more exclusive? Do you think that more brands will follow in their footsteps?
I think it depends on the brand, because a brand like Chanel is like so desirable that I think they're thinking of more and more ways to, you know, capture the customer, keep things exclusive. I think it very much depends on the brand.
Yeah.
If it's like a super brand or not.
No filter. So moving now into kind of more of the fashion side of the podcast, I suppose, in terms of clothing and accessories for our listeners. Yes. What items of clothing and accessories would you find inside an entrepreneurial woman's or power woman's wardrobe?
I guess for mine, definitely a tuxedo. I have a few different tuxedos in different colours. Especially for meetings, I think once you put a tuxedo on or a suit on, it makes you feel automatically powerful, with some heels and a red lip. My go-to is always a red lip from day to night. If I'm out having meetings and then I've got, you know, drinks or something with a client after, I just need to like freshen up a bit, I like literally just put on a red lip and I'm good to go. Also a black dress. I have like hundreds of black dresses. I can never go wrong with them, from like cocktail dresses to long dresses. That's like, you know, because when you have evening events, yes, you're at these events, you're at these like cocktail parties, you're at like the film festival, but you're also kind of working as well. Because I work with a lot of celebrities, and I'm on red carpet with them, or I'm at an event with them. It's also like, I'm not the celebrity. So that's why I always wear black. Still glam, still presentable, but I always have like my black dress on, because it's, you know, it's all about the celebrity and it's all about marketing them. I think where a lot of people blur the lines there.
Almost like wearing white to a wedding.
A white to a wedding, exactly. So there's a lot of black in my wardrobe, also because it's professional. It looks great, and you know, you can't go wrong. Yeah. No matter how you're feeling, looking, like, just put the black dress on or the black suit on, you're good to go.
Yeah, that's really good advice. Thank you.
Yeah.
So what What is your favorite, I suppose, high street brand? Do you wear high street brands, or would you class that as fast fashion?
I mean, I guess I can't wear designer clothes all the time. I do wear high street brands. Just thinking, I do buy a lot from like upcoming new designers, like high street designers.
Yeah, I suppose my question should have been more affordable brands.
Affordable, brands. Oh my god. No, I actually can't even think now.
Massive beauty, lovely designer clothes. I'm not surprised.
But I buy like high street, meaning like Massimo Dutti. I feel like I say that it's like an old lady brand, but I kind of like it. And like Joseph, and it used to be Zara, but I don't know. I think it's like the quality's gone down a bit, and the design aspect is not as good as it used to be. I was a huge Zara fan years ago, but I think there's lots of other high street brands, you know, that you can buy like a lot of things from, which are usable. What else? Like, even for basics, I'd go to like Uniqlo. That's like a good one for like the t-shirts and the sweaters and things.
T-shirts I really struggle with, you know, finding the right cup for the arm and
Sure
it's not really up my armpit.
Well, I don't struggle with it
to my trunk as well. It's really difficult for me, and you know, I'm quite normal size, so yeah, these basic things that you take for granted.
It's very hard to find them nowadays. Uniqlo, it's quite good. And Gap was as well, actually. I'm just actually trying to think of the high street, but I feel like so many of the high street brands have closed down now.
Yeah.
Like if you think of Oxford Street, there's nothing there anymore.
No, I agree with you. It's the same, it's more or less the same shop over and over again.
Over and over again, yeah.
What about basics in terms of your basic staples in more, I suppose, couture shops? Where
do
I find the perfect white tee?
So something like a white tee, I wouldn't buy from a designer brand because I just think it's a waste of money. Yeah. So I'd get that from a Uniqlo or like even like a Marks and Spencer's. I do like Marks and Spencer's because I think the quality is always good, and it's, you know, you can wash it a million times and it's still great. I get my staple pieces like my jackets, maybe like a dress or some trousers from the more luxury brand stores, which I will wear like for years and years and years. They're like, I'd always suggest like get like the staple coat, or you know, the waistcoat, or the black dress, you know, because they also last longer than something off the high street, just because it's more tailor-made. And then, you know, you can mix it up with your high street basics.
Yeah.
Like a cardigan or a t-shirt, or, and one thing I would do is I wear a lot of jewelry. I love jewelry, so I'd bring out like a dress or a jacket from like 10 years ago, and I'd be like, oh my god, like where's this from? I was like, this is 10 years old, like I've had it for years and years and years. I put it away like in the cupboard, like in my parents' attic, and then I literally go into the attic and be like, oh, this is nice, and I'll bring it back out again after a few years. And then I just add like a gold necklace or some big earrings. I've actually got a lot of my mom's jewelry from the 80s, all these like big sort of round earrings and this like pearl necklace with like green stones, and I've layered necklaces up and then I wear it. So that's also a cool thing to do. Even a grandmother's jewelry, just like, I'm obviously, you know, my grandma doesn't wear anything anymore, so I'll just literally go through it all on my aunts, and they'd be like, here she is again, like going through it. And I was like it's so cool. I was like, this is what people are wearing now, but you've got the originals. So if you see my jewelry box, it's full of like vintage jewelry and new stuff as well, but yeah, I love putting all the vintage like 80s and 90s jewelry back on.
It's great that you have a mix. Like I try to invest in good shoes to wear and coats and handbags. I haven't managed to invest in kind of like really high quality work outfits yet. I've just had a huge clear out of my wardrobe and thrown away so much, I suppose, high street stuff because the quality is not you know,
culture's not there,
the
yeah.
quality's not there. And by the time I start my job in a year's time, they're just, it's just going to be really dated, and it's not kind of the kind of stuff that is going to be, well, first of all, appropriate for me to wear in my new job, but also, you know, appropriate to wear out of the house because it's going to look old. So, yeah, it is nice to have that mix and to blend kind of like everyday, more affordable basics that aren't going to go out of fashion with these high qualities as well that's going to be around for a long time, because the quality is going to be there as well. And when you were talking about wearing, you know, the vintage jewelry, this kind of stuff, you know, it does, fashions do, they do come back around again. I know what I'm just saying about the clothes.
Yeah,
because the quality is not there with the clothes sometimes, but yeah, it's not good for the hoarder inside of me knowing that I need to stash all this stuff just in case it comes back into fashion.
I mean, I'm very, like, my parents let me use their attic because they were like, this is too much. I was like, no, because it's going to come back into fashion. She's like, are you going to wear it, my mum? I was like, yes, I will. And I purposely, I pull it out again. I was like, see, I'm wearing it. Just so I can justify the storage space in their attic. And another thing I do actually is I take my brother's suits, like their tuxedos. I've got two or three of them. My brother had this like jade green Cavalli suit, which doesn't fit him. And I've taken it and I took it to the tailor's and just altered it a little bit so it fits me like around the waist and the side. But I love it. I wear it all the time. I roll the sleeves up. The jacket's a bit longer, obviously, because it's like for a man. And the trousers with the waist, I've had it taken in. And I wear his like tuxedo all the time.
Excellent.
So that's like another, I was like, I don't know why people don't do that often.
Like, well, my mum had an Aussie Clark dress from like 40 years ago. And I no idea what she was doing in it, but it ended up in our fancy dress box when we were kids with rips up all to the side of it. My mum must have been some crazy party animal in her time. But because it was beautiful, I got it tailored and it's fixed now. I haven't managed to wear it out yet, but you've inspired me to wear it. So perhaps next time I go out, I'll get out
the
vintage Aussie Clark.
Yeah, love it.
So, I mean, I think that when I look and feel my best, I perform much better at work. In your opinion, how do you think that busy professionals can ensure that they have a work-life balance in order to, I suppose, have the time to ensure they're looking and feeling their best, if, you know, that does inspire a person to do well at work?
Because I always think sometimes, like, when I'm feeling, like, a bit low and I've got to go to work, like, putting on a great outfit always, like, cheers me up and gives me that power. Even little things like going for a blow dry. You know, when your hair's good, you automatically feel better and look better. So I do schedule in, especially, you know, if it's for an event or I'm busy and it's like, okay, let's just get a blow dryer. But now it's so easy. You have all these apps that can come home and just blow dry your hair for you. So you don't have to go anywhere. Things like that, massages, that really helps, because, like, especially when you're stressed and you're working nonstop, like, I'll, after like a big trip or I've like worked at Milan Fashion Week and, you know, there's been all these late nights and the flights, I'll come home and I'll schedule in a massage, because your body hurts as well and you've got to work again the next day. So I think little things of like caring for yourself by, you know, doing these massages, hair things, also what you put into your body. I always think that hot water and lemon every morning does me wonders, because your body is quite acidic. So they always say to keep your body as alkaline as possible. So I also drink, I'm a bit fancy, I drink alkaline water, because I know, like, that's one of the main things that goes into your body. So it's like, I try to keep it as alkaline as possible, because I know the rest of the week it's going to be a complete mess. So little things in the morning, I think, is like the best thing for you to like uplift your mood.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I've actually only just started having massages in all of my time, but I can't imagine. I can't imagine life without them.
I can't imagine life without them. I know.
God, I sound kind of like, I don't know, a bit terrible saying that, but yeah, they are really beneficial just to need all of the attention out of your body. So relate to what you're saying,
because we carry all the stress from like the day, like in our body, in our shoulders and our back and everything, and then, you know, you can't think properly. So if there's someone just to help it, knead it out, get rid of it, like it clears your system and you can like rethink projects and like not be stressed over like the smallest thing, which happens when, you know, you're physically mentally exhausted.
I do the lemon water as well in the morning, but I put a bit of salt in it, which makes it taste surprisingly nice. I think that it's a hack. I think it makes the water more alkaline, so you probably have nothing to worry about. And I'm not, to be honest, I'm not sure how much salt is meant to go into the into the water, so I'm potentially like overdosing myself with salt.
I don't
have a blood test because the sodium levels will probably be really high.
Like over the roof, they'd be like, what are you doing? We're gonna have to switch this up a bit.
But yeah, the lemon water is really nice just in the morning, I think, to freshen you up. So perhaps listeners don't follow in my footsteps, follow in Chadney's and try the alkaline water.
Alkaline water is good. It's really that's helped a lot for me. It's like neutralized my inner system.
So we're coming to the end of the interview now. So my final question is, how can people find out more about CJM Publicity?
I have an Instagram page at CJM Publicity where I'm like, you know, always posting about work, deals that I'm, you know, partnership deals that I've been working on, my clients, my talent. I think that's probably the best way to keep connected is follow the Instagram page, also my personal page as well. That's a mixture of like my everyday life mixed with my work life. It looks fabulous, but trust me, behind the scenes it's like it takes a lot of time, late nights and a lot of effort to put that page up. There's always I have a website, but that's like very brief. It just touches like a snapshot of like all the services that I offer. And again, yeah, I'm always open to like, you know, if anybody wants any help, give me a call, email me. I'm always happy to mentor. I'm always like an open door. Like I do want to help the next generation you know, succeed and do better than me as well. So I was like, I've learned it, I've been through this whole process, so I'm more than happy to help anyone who's starting off with a business, to give them some advice, hold out their hand and, you know, put them in the right direction.
Excellent. Well, I'll put tags to, you know, all of your Instagram accounts and your website in the show notes. So if anybody would like to check out her pages, Chadney's pages, just follow the links in the show notes. For all of our listeners, it is Saturday today. Me and Chadney are having a little bit of a Saturday spa day. We've both following our well-being advice, we're taking that advice on ourselves. So I'm gonna let you go and enjoy the rest of your Saturday, and really just say thank you very much for being a guest on Hashtag No Filter and providing such an interesting and insightful glimpse into your world, and for sharing your career advice with the listeners.
Oh, thank you so much, Stephanie. It's been amazing, and I've really looked forward to speaking to you, and I hope to like catch up with you again soon.
Definitely. And thank you to everybody for tuning into another episode of Hashtag No Filter, and we'll see you back again here next time. Need help, need help, need help, need help.